Hello everyone, Helena here. Welcome back to section 2 of my podcast on Caravaggio's Supper at Emmaus. In section 1, we compared Titian's version of the story with Caravaggio's. And now, in section 2, we're going to look in more detail at Caravaggio's painting. In the Bible story, the setting is a village of Emmaus, which is some 7 miles or 11 kilometres outside of Jerusalem. But Caravaggio reimagines the story in a tavern in Rome, one of his favourites possibly for meeting up with friends, for drinks, arguments, possibly even fights. Because apart from the timeless biblical robes of Christ, everything in the painting, the furniture, the tableware, the clothing of the other characters, the face of Christ, everything is contemporary to Caravaggio's own time. Let's start with the figure of Christ. Christ is placed literally centre stage in the painting. With Caravaggio, the theatrical analogy is always appropriate. Because everything in this painting, the dramatic lighting effects, the plain backdrop, the dramatic gestures and expressions of the protagonists, everything has the atmosphere about it of the theatre. Christ is seated at the centre of the table, facing us, on which has been placed a white tablecloth over a patterned carpet. And on the table, a simple supper has been laid out for the disciples and Christ to enjoy. We can see a rather scrawny-looking chicken, some solid and substantial rolls of bread, a pottery jug possibly containing wine, a vase half filled with water, behind it a wine glass, and last but by no means least, a basket laden with fruit, which includes grapes, pomegranates, apples and pears. And it's the same basket of fruit which Caravaggio used in his still life composition of 1596, which is one of the earliest pure still life compositions in existence. As I mentioned in my 3-part podcast, Caravaggio was a real champion of and pioneer in the field of the still life genre. He uses almost the same fruit in the 2 paintings and also the same eye-catching device. And that is to have the basket balanced precariously over the edge of its support. In the case of the pure still life, it's a shelf. In this case, it's the table. And it's a clever device used to bring the viewer into the painting, because instinctively we want to rush forward and push the basket back into a position of relative safety in the middle of the table. In doing so, we find ourselves occupying the empty place at the table, which has been reserved especially for us. And this is one way of Caravaggio implying that the gifts offered by Christ's resurrection, salvation and eternal life, and blessings in our present earthly life, are just as available to us as they were to the people of Christ's own time. So by taking up our seat at the table, we can enjoy communion with Christ and the benefits of his blessing offered by his extended right arm. At first sight, the arm may appear to be blessing the food on the table and the company present. But look more closely. Through Caravaggio's skillful use of foreshortening, the arm appears to be breaking the membrane of the canvas, extending out of the picture into our space, our time. So we are offered the blessing too. Well, having occupied our place at the table, what do we see? Well, we're facing the figure of Christ, wearing the robes of victory, the resurrection colours of red and white, seen on the flag, red cross on a white background, which Christ is often shown holding in resurrection pictures, red symbolising his sacrifice and white his resurrection, reminding us of the shroud left discarded in the empty tomb after his resurrection. Christ's left arm rests on the table. His hand is lifted to bless the bread in front of him. See how the hand is tinged with a glowing red light. and that is where Caravaggio has shown the reflected light from the tablecloth, which has projected the red of Christ's robe onto his lower hand, bathing it in a gentle glowing light. Such a beautiful, subtle detail. It shows that Caravaggio wasn't just the king of chiaroscuro, he was the master of reflected light too. And then, as I've already pointed out, the right arm is extended to blessing the food on the table, and by breaking out into our space, extends the blessing to us. The arm also serves as a measuring device to give us some idea, in theory at least, of how close we are to the figure of Christ, which makes even more stark the contrast between the remoteness of Titian's Christ and the closeness of Caravaggio's figure. We might expect to feel nervous in the presence of Christ, but do we? Unlike Titian's Christ, where the figure is full length, but quite small, and his face half cast in shadow, in Caravaggio's painting, the face is much larger, and we can see it more clearly. And what a face! It's striking because of its ordinariness. This is no idealised version of Christ, like Titian's. Now, this is all subjective, but to my mind, he's rather plain-looking, a man who might go unnoticed if you passed him in the street. He's a man in his early 30s, beardless, his face rather pudgy, and with his clean-shaven complexion and flowing locks, he's somewhat androgynous in appearance. Not surprisingly, his appearance would have shocked many of Caravaggio's contemporaries, and I'll refer to that controversy later on. But his expression is calm and serene. His eyes are downcast, as he's fully absorbed in his act of blessing. To the right of Christ stands the innkeeper, wearing a white cap and apron and a puzzled expression directed towards one of the disciples of Christ. He can't understand what all the fuss is about. Why, he thinks, are these two companions of Christ reacting so dramatically to a man blessing bread? It's beyond his comprehension. And if we put ourselves in his position, with his lack of knowledge about the story, we'd feel surprised too. The actions of the disciples, which are intended to convey their astonishment at the miracle they are witnessing, are very dramatic, very physical. On the opposite side of the table, sitting with his back towards us, is the disciple who is often identified as Cleopas, though there's nothing to prove this is the case. He grips the arms of his chair in disbelief. And it is the same Savonarola chair which Caravaggio used in his painting of the calling of St. Matthew. Though we can only see his bearded face in profile, his eyes, wide open like saucers, betray his state of surprise. He appears to be on the point of leaping out of his chair, his elbows jutting out towards us. His scruffy green jacket has a tear at the right elbow, revealing the white undershirt beneath. And what a clever artistic trick on the part of Caravaggio, because it appears to us that he has actually torn the jacket as a result of ripping the canvas, of invading our space. And then to the right-hand side of the painting is the other disciple not identified in the narrative. He flings open wide his arms in disbelief, and his gesture mimics Christ on the cross, as though he's framing the question in his mind. How can it be that a man who was crucified, dead and buried, is alive and taking a meal with us tonight? With regard to his identity, it's possible that Caravaggio imagined him to be the figure of St. Peter. One reason for this is that a careful reading of the scriptures suggests that when the two men relate their story to the disciples, they imply that one of those who saw Christ was Saint Peter. Also, if you look at the painting by Caravaggio of the crucifixion of Saint Peter, the face of Saint Peter looks very similar to the face of the disciple in this painting. which further supports the idea that Caravaggio had in mind for his unidentified disciple the figure of St. Peter. Another theory is that it may be the figure of St. James the Greater, and that is partly because the disciple is wearing on his brown mantle the badge of the scallop shell, which is the symbol of St. James. Also, it's thought that Caravaggio based the disciple's dramatic gesture on that of St. James the Greater in Leonardo's fresco of the Last Supper, in the same way that Titian had modelled the back-leaning gesture of his green-robed disciple on the figure of Judas Iscariot in the same painting. Now, it's possible that St. James the Greater was the disciple Caravaggio had in mind, but it must be pointed out that the scallop shell is not exclusively the symbol of that saint. It was also a general badge worn by pilgrims. In any case, the identity of either or both disciples is not crucial to the story. But what does seem clear is that Caravaggio has put into practice Leonardo's dictum that an artist should, through gesture, express the human soul and passion. This disciple clearly wears his heart on his sleeve. And it's another very dramatic and skillful use of the art of foreshortening. Just as the elbow of Cleopas and the right hand of Christ appear to invade our space, so too do the fingertips of the left hand of the unidentified disciple come right up to the surface of the canvas, almost touching us. And again, it serves as a measuring device, just like the right arm of Christ. With his right hand very close to the wall of the tavern and his left hand almost touching us, it shows us just how shallow the room is and how close we are to Christ and his disciples. But we don't just feel their proximity, we feel their presence. There is an uncanny sense of realism as well as drama to this painting. It's not difficult for us to believe that we are really, truly there. And so much is due to that chiaroscuro, that dramatic contrast between light and shade, which give the figures form and three dimension and make them come to life in such a vivid way. But Caravaggio doesn't use chiaroscuro simply for the purposes of realism and drama. He also uses it to underpin the spiritual message of the story. And it's perfect for this because light is one of the most commonly used metaphors in the Bible. God is light, and Christ is described as the light of the world. We talk about the light of salvation, of knowledge, of understanding, of truth and goodness. This metaphorical light, used for spiritual purposes, will always take precedence over realism and drama in Caravaggio's works. Indeed, Caravaggio is willing to distort the light of realism in order to serve the purposes of the spiritual message. For example, where the innkeeper stands, he should, in reality, cast a shadow over the face of Christ. But there's no way that Caravaggio is going to allow the leading character in the drama to be upstaged in that way. God is light, and so the presence of God is made clear in this painting through the face of Christ being bathed in light, confirming his divine status and witnessing to the glory of the resurrection. The innkeeper does cast a shadow, but it's against the wall of the tavern. And if you look closely, you'll notice the shadow forms a halo above Christ's head. It's no fluke, it's deliberate. It's Caravaggio revealing the presence of God through the use of shadow play. And he does this also with the basket of fruit. A combination of the fruits cast a shadow onto the tablecloth on the right-hand side, which, if you look, takes the image of half a fish. You can make out the body and the tail. And the fish was an early symbol of the Christian believer. And it's a reminder of Christ's remarks to St. Peter in the miraculous draught of fishes story, which is told in the Gospel of St. Luke, chapter 5. After Christ has enabled the disciples to pull in a huge haul of fish, he tells Peter that in future he will be the fisher of men rather than fish. And so the fish alludes to the missionary activities of the two disciples at the Emmaus Supper. Because as witnesses to the resurrection and now having a clear understanding of Christ's mission and purpose on earth, they will be able to go out into the world as they literally invade our space and spread the good news of the gospel. But the metaphor of light, which is used most strongly in this painting, is that which stands for spiritual enlightenment, spiritual knowledge. The disciples are shown to be in the light because they not only physically, visually recognize Christ, but they spiritually understand his true identity and purpose on earth. The innkeeper, by contrast, is shown in the shadow, in the dark, because though he can see Christ physically, he doesn't know him, so he can't believe Christ to be the Son of God. So he represents all those who are literally in the dark, the non-believer and those who are yet to be brought to the knowledge of Christ. He stands, if you like, outside the charmed triangle, the triangle which is formed by the heads of Christ and the disciples, with Christ at the apex of that triangle, a triangle that binds together the believers with Christ and is also a symbol of the Holy Trinity, God the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So the idea that God has taken on human form in the person of Christ, and that when Christ departed this earth, he left behind the Holy Spirit to give the disciples the knowledge, courage, and strength they needed to spread the good news of the gospel, and also to bring comfort, guidance, and wisdom to all those who invite the Spirit into their lives. The painting also demonstrates Caravaggio's breathtaking virtuosity in the genre of still life. I mean, the fruit in the basket looks good enough to eat. Even if the apple is somewhat rotten, note the visible wormhole, I'd be happy to take a bite out of it and the juicy pear and grab myself a handful of grapes. And the bread may be a bit overbaked and the chicken a bit on the small side to share among three. Possibly that's why Christ took an early departure from the supper, so he could kindly leave the disciples to share the chicken between themselves. And in any case, he gets to have a nice meal of fish in the next episode of the story. But that's just me being a bit fanciful. And look at the way he gives us the different textures and materials. The pottery of the jug, the glass of the vase, and the reflection of the light on the water within it. And he even shows us the construction of the chair which Cleopas has been occupying. Such meticulous attention to detail. But it's not just realism for realism's sake. It's not just intended as a vehicle to demonstrate Caravaggio's brilliance as an artist. Everything in the painting has significance beyond its physical reality. So the bread on the table stands for the body of Christ and the incarnation. The water may stand for spiritual rebirth through baptism. The grapes for Christ's blood and sacrifice. The pomegranate for immortality, the apple for the fall of man and original sin, for which Christ's sacrifice has served as an atonement, and the scrawny chicken and rotten fruit and the fact that the basket is about to topple off the table. All this serves to remind us that this food can only satisfy our physical needs, which are earthly and temporary, whereas the spiritual food offered by Christ is satisfying and fulfilling, permanent and eternal. Caravaggio is also suggesting that the more you can believe in the authenticity of his painting, the more you can believe in the reality of the miracle taking place. So if you can really truly believe that the food is edible, and that the fruit basket is going to fall onto your floor if you don't take swift action, and that if you don't look out, you're going to be winded in the stomach by the elbow of Cleopas and whacked in the face by the left hand of his companion, and that if you move in close enough, you'll feel the right hand of Christ touching your head as he blesses you, and if you can truly believe that these two men, scruffy, with dirty fingernails, unkempt hair, one with a torn jacket, the other with a red nose that implies he's had a drink too many, if you can truly believe that these two men were the disciples of Christ, maybe fishermen, and if you can also believe, and maybe most importantly of all, believe in Caravaggio's Christ, who though claimed to be the Son of God, was also a human being. So maybe he was handsome. Maybe he did really look like Robert Powell in Jesus of Nazareth. But maybe he didn't. Maybe he was rather ordinary looking, pudgy-faced, like this man here. And that's okay, isn't it? So Caravaggio is posing the question to us. If you can believe in the reality of my painting, believe you are there, participating in the events as they unfold before your eyes, then surely you can believe in the miracle of the resurrection, that Christ is alive today and offers salvation to all. Now, irrespective of how you may respond to the spiritual and religious aspects of the painting, and that's the genius of Caravaggio, he speaks to our humanity rather than to our religion or faith, it's generally regarded as a superb work of art, a masterpiece in every sense. One interesting feature about Caravaggio's work is that he didn't do any underlying drawings in his painting. And that was quite a novel and unusual practice for his time. It's hard to believe that he didn't do any preparatory studies for his paintings, but none survive. So even that can't be proven. And this is all the more incredible when you consider that X-rays and infrareds have revealed that he made very few changes to this painting. Now, changes by an artist are known as pentimenti, from the Italian pentorsi, meaning to repent or change one's mind. The one significant alteration he made to the painting regards the left leg of the unidentified disciple. Originally, Caravaggio placed it in front of the table. Then he changed his mind and tucked it under the table instead. And this reinforces and enhances the dramatic arm gesture of the disciple, as well as the impact of the foreshortening. And it also helps us to focus our attention more fully on the basket of fruit. So we're drawn into the picture and occupy the empty space at the table. Another interesting feature of Caravaggio's working methods is that he used live models in his studio, another revolutionary idea. And again, X-rays have given us a better understanding of his working practices. Using the back of his paintbrush or a tool, he would mark on the primed surface of his canvas the respective positions of the figures in the painting. So when there were breaks in the painting sessions, the models would know where to resume their positions when the work recommenced. The high quality of the finish is simply breathtaking. You can barely see the brush strokes. It almost has the glossy appearance of a photograph. And Caravaggio achieved this effect by mixing his pigments with a large quantity of walnut oil. And then he applied the paint in a very liquid form, and this gave a smooth finish to his painting. Now, despite the fact that this was a private commission, the painting nonetheless attracted its critics. One notable one was Giovanni Bellori, who was an antiquarian, an art theorist, and one of Caravaggio's biographers. Despite his frequent criticism of Caravaggio for slavishly imitating nature at the expense of creative expression, a criticism which Michelangelo frequently levelled at the northern Renaissance artists, notably Van Eyck, Bellori was frustrated by the fact that the fruit in the basket was seasonally inaccurate. Caravaggio's fruits were autumnal, whereas Bellori argued that they should have been the fruits of the spring, to coincide with the actual dates of Christ's crucifixion. He fails to understand that Caravaggio has selected the fruit not on the grounds of seasonal authenticity, but on spiritual symbolism. So the apple represents the fall of man, the grapes, Christ's sacrifice, the pomegranate, immortality. And not surprisingly, in arguing over the authenticity of the fruit, Bellori fails to notice the image of the fish, cast in shadow on the table. In focusing on minor details, he fails to see the much more important messages contained within the picture. Bellori also took exception at the way that the innkeeper was depicted. Surely Caravaggio would have understood that it was disrespectful of the innkeeper not to remove his cap in the presence of Christ. But again, he misses the point entirely. The innkeeper doesn't know who Christ is, so why should he act in a deferential way? And yet his presence at the supper is absolutely crucial to the authenticity of the story, because the innkeeper, as a non-believer, will be able to serve as an impartial witness to the appearance of Christ at the supper that day. Bellori, like many people, didn't like the fact that Caravaggio showed the disciples as ordinary people rather than idealised versions of themselves. Indeed, his use of ordinary people as models for the figure of Christ, the disciples and other followers of Christ was hugely controversial, particularly when it involved using prostitutes to model for the figure of the Virgin Mary. But turning to this painting in particular, to show the disciples as poor, with scruffy clothing, unkempt hair, dirty fingernails, was considered by critics to be vulgar, offensive, disrespectful to the disciples. Now, ironically, Caravaggio's very clear, honest, and direct way of telling the Bible stories that would appeal to the masses was totally in tune with the demands of the Counter-Reformation Roman Catholic Church. But there were those who felt he went too far. It was one thing to be truthful and direct. It was quite another to be disrespectful and irreverent. And there was even an underlying concern that in focusing on Christ's message to the poor, it gave the poor ideas above their station and the license to challenge those in authority, whereas art that was over the top, overwhelming, that forced people to look up in awe and wonder, that reverential art invited a deferential response. It kept the poor in their place. Whereas Caravaggio's art, with its direct appeal to the poor, had too much of the rebellious, seditious feel about it to be acceptable. But it was perhaps the figure of Christ that shocked the most. This is no idealised version of Christ, no reverential depiction of the Son of God. It's a very ordinary face, no chiselled cheekbones, striking jaw, aquiline nose, smouldering, brooding, handsome appearance. It's just a pudgy, plump face. And with his long hair and smooth complexion, there's even a sense of ambiguity as to Christ's sexuality. It would have been quite shocking to many of his contemporaries. Had it been a work for a public building, it would almost certainly have been rejected. But the fact that it was a private commission gave Caravaggio the freedom to present in his painting what he must have believed to be an honest portrait of Christ. But what Caravaggio is doing more than anything is challenging our assumptions about Christ and his appearance. It worked with me. You see, it took me a long while to warm to this painting, and I realised it was fundamentally because I didn't like Caravaggio's portrayal of Christ. For me, Christ had to look like Robert Powell in Jesus of Nazareth, the 1970s TV film directed by Franco Zeffirelli. And you can imagine my shock and dismay when I next saw Christ sporting a tight curly perm as Richard Hannay in the 1980s version of the film of the 39 Steps. But then I realised that it wasn't Caravaggio's depiction of Christ that was at fault, but rather it was my assumptions about Christ's appearance that needed challenging and the importance that I attached to how he looked. But aside from all the controversy, Caravaggio was really trying to help explain why Christ wasn't recognised at first by the disciples. In St. Mark's shorter version of the story, told in chapter 16, verse 12, Christ is said to have appeared to the disciples in a different form or manner. And so by showing Christ beardless and wearing colourful robes, it may help explain why they didn't initially recognise him. Caravaggio did, in case, have a precedence for showing a beardless Christ. Michelangelo, back in the 1540s, had placed a young and beardless Christ at the centre of his Last Judgment painting on the altar wall of the Sistine Chapel. His version of Christ was based on the early traditions in Christian Rome, where Christ was often shown in the guise of the Roman sun god Apollo. But more significant than the face of Christ is the hands. If you look at Michelangelo's fresco of the Last Judgment, the left arm of Christ turns away the swarthing masses of the damned towards hell, while with his right arm and hand he welcomes the blessed who are entering the kingdom of heaven. If you compare the hand gestures of Michelangelo's Christ with those of Caravaggio's in the Last Supper at Emmaus, you'll see how Caravaggio has appropriated Michelangelo's Christ's gestures and adapted them with very little modification. So it's deliberate. Caravaggio wants you to make that connection back to Michelangelo's Christ of the Last Judgment. Through this appropriation, Caravaggio is implying that Christ's appearance before the two disciples at Emmaus prefigures his final appearance before the whole human race on the last day of judgment. Now, while the Supper of Emmaus was painted when Caravaggio was at the height of success and fame in his professional life, his personal life was spiralling rapidly out of control. The painting lends itself to a rather humorous bubble-captioned dialogue between the innkeeper and the unidentified disciple. It would run as follows. Innkeeper to the disciple. So you're telling me this artist bloke Caravaggio's got form? Disciple to innkeeper. He's got a criminal record longer than both my arms, mate. Cue the arm gesture. And it wouldn't be much of an exaggeration. From the year 1599 to 1606, Caravaggio was frequently getting into trouble with the authorities for carrying his sword through the streets of Rome without an appropriate license, for assaulting a waiter over an argument about a plate of artichokes, for publishing scurrilous verses about a fellow artist, for throwing stones at the windows of his landlady's home because she had locked him out of his apartment for non-payment of rent and damage to the property. And all of this would culminate in his killing a man in a duel over possibly an unpaid debt or the honour of a lady. And from then on, he was on the run for the rest of his life. Few artists knew as well as Caravaggio did what it was like to be pursued by the authorities. And it's possibly because he was able to draw so much upon real life experiences that he produced such a superb work of art in the form of his third and final commission for Ciriaco Mattei. And that was The Taking of Christ, which is the subject of my second podcast in this two-part series on Easter story paintings by Caravaggio. Well, I do hope you've enjoyed this podcast and that I'll enjoy your company for the second one when that is released. In the meantime, I hope you're able to take advantage of all the different services offered by London Walks in the form of the podcasts, in particular the virtual tours, where you can explore places in London, the UK and abroad, or join tours that have a special theme to them, all to enjoy from the comfort of your armchair and in the company of one of the many superb London Walks guides who bring their expertise and profound knowledge to every tour they undertake, as well as their very distinct personal style. All the guides have a very friendly, warm and approachable manner, so you really feel you're getting a one-to-one private tour with the guide. Then there are the regular walks, many of them outdoors, which are gradually being reintroduced into the programme as the restrictions of lockdown are lifted. So much to look forward to over the coming months. And to make sure you're up to date with all the latest information, check out the London Walks website, That's the three W's, londonwalks.com. Have a wonderful spring. Goodbye.